Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, and we have our own website now, offgridchristianity.co.uk. So please enjoy today's guest, who is an author, and fortunately, she enjoys writing as well, which is a good start. She also likes goal setting. But what is goal setting, apart from the obvious? And why does she mention this in her brief bio on the back of the book? Our guest also mentions cake eating, which is a big thumbs up from me. And our guest is also a communication support worker for deaf students. And her husband, Rod, is a magician, hopefully of the trick of illusion type. So, does our guest know the difference between a gatto and a Queen Victoria sponge? Why and what is goal setting important? What does a communication support worker do? What is it like to work alongside children who are deaf? Does our guest husband say abracadabra? What is her latest book, When God Butts In, Finding Strength to Face the Impossible, all about? And why does she write it? All these questions and more, better find out the answers as well, from today's guest, and that is Kate Williams. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today. Where are we speaking to you from?
I am in Bradford, West Yorkshire, a small town called Idle, but that doesn't mean I'm lazy.
Named after Eric, was it, by chance? You don't know who Eric Idle is, do you?
Not a clue, no.
Shame my age.
Does that mean I'm young?
It means you're very young.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it means you've never even heard of Monty Python, so, you know.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Sounds as if you're next to a main road or something. We hear cars going by every so often.
I am on a main road indeed, yeah.
Well, let's go for the five important or not so important questions. Ooh. Kate, question one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Okay, so when I read this question, I was a little bit nervous. It took me back in time to a life group about 10 years ago where I was asked the same question, but I was asked to name three people I would like to invite for an evening meal. Now, at this life group, I made the mistake of going first, which is never a good idea, is it? So my very honest answers were Peter Kay and Anton Deck. Because I just thought, how much fun would that dinner party be?
Yes.
But as it moved around the room, I felt very unspiritual as people were saying, well, I would have Jesus and Mother Teresa and Moses. And I was like, oh, I didn't really read the room very well on that one. But in this case, I'm going to go for Adrian Plass.
Okay.
Yeah. Because my reason for that is, obviously, you've said writing is one of my passions. Yeah. It's something that I've had a real growing interest in. And he is my favourite writer. He's the writer that's had the most influence, I would say, on my life. So I would just love to have a meal with him. I have met him, but only very briefly, just kind of hello and signing a book kind of thing. But I would just love to have some quality time with Adrian Plass because I just think he's a wonderful human.
Okay, why does he resonate so much with you then?
So I grew up reading his books, you know, The Sacred Diaries, and just loved his humour, but I loved his realness. I found him such a good balance of being funny, but also making you think.
Yes.
And of kind of laughing at the daft things that happen in church life, because I was experiencing a lot of that and thinking, is there something wrong with me that I'm finding quite a lot of things funny? You know, am I really irreverent? Am I actually saved? What's, you know, is there something wrong with me? But reading his books made me feel really reassured that actually you can laugh at funny stuff that happens in church and not be irreverent. Like, because I think he gets a lovely balance of laughing, but never slagging off the church and never running it down. Like, he obviously loves the church. And I just feel that he gets a lovely balance of that.
Yes. No, he was one of the main reasons, I suppose, for me keeping going in my Christian faith when I finally, in brackets, reluctantly, all those sorts of stories that, you know, people can share, like C.S. Lewis. So he was one of my early mentors, I suppose, from a reading point of view, and I devoured every single book. Yeah.
Yeah, I just love his rawness in his more personal writing, you know, how honest he is about things he's experienced that have been difficult, and that's really rubbed off on me, and I want to write in a similar way, where I'm honest about the stuff that's difficult. I think people have had enough of this perfect, you know, Christian leader or Christian person who's got it all together, perfect family, perfect finances, everything's great. You know, it's just not real life. And I think Adrian Plass has really inspired me that actually your vulnerability, your rawness, your realness – can reach a lot more people.
You mean you haven't got a perfect family, perfect finances, perfect house? You haven't got those?
I haven't, no.
Well, that's the end of this podcast. End of. Thank you so much
nice
for joining.
To meet
yes.
You.
Thank
yeah,
you.
I'll put the kettle on.
A great answer. Thank you very much indeed. And no just problem. To cheer you up a bit, I had a similar sort of question many, many moons ago when applying for a job. The last question was, if you could have any job in the world, what would you want to have? So I wrote down, I want to be the drummer with Aerosmith, because I'm a drummer and I loved Aerosmith. And that helped me get the job. There you go.
Wow.
So your answers were good enough for me.
Brilliant. I'm pleased to hear.
Question two, who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please?
Okay, so my favourite biblical character is a Canaanite woman found in Matthew 15. Now, this used to be the passage in the Bible that I most struggled with, but it's actually now turned into the one that I love probably the most, definitely at the minute. So I actually write about this in my book. So I'm going to just read a couple of paragraphs to you about this particular character because it directly answers this question.
Brilliant.
So one of my favorite people in the Bible is a woman whose name we don't know, but she had such a feisty level of faith that it greatly impressed Jesus. I think we need to follow this sassy sister's lead and persist in faith for our breakthrough because we recognize that Jesus truly can butt in and transform our impossible situation. The mountain in front of this woman was a big one. Her daughter was possessed by a demon. She was a mum who was desperate for her daughter to be healed. She was a Canaanite woman, a Gentile, which meant she was an enemy of the Jews. The dialogue between her and Jesus is quite an uncomfortable read, and I've struggled with this passage for a long time because of the way Jesus speaks to her. It's almost like he himself is acting as a mountain blocking her miracle. She comes to him and begs him to heal her daughter, and he promptly tells her that his mission is to save the Jews, as at this point in the Bible, that was his primary focus. But she won't let it drop. She wants to see her daughter healed, and she recognized that Jesus had the power to butt in and cast out the demon from her daughter. Jesus says to her, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." I mean, how rude. How rude is that, you know? And that what he meant was he'd come for the Jews, not the Gentiles. Surely Jesus could have phrased his letdown in a nicer way. Undeterred by his apparent offensive refusal to help, she challenges Jesus, saying, "Yes, it is, Lord. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." It's an unusual text, as Jesus so often comes across as compassionate and loving, and it can appear here that he's harsh and blatantly rude. But her quick-witted, bold, faith-fueled comeback really grabs his attention. He is impressed by this sassy lassie so much that he says, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter experienced healing from the moment he said those words. I've grown to love this story that I've wrestled to understand over the years, as this bold woman challenges Jesus and he takes note and acts because of her faith. In a patriarchal culture where women were second class, this Gentile woman, who had so much stacked against her, refuses to be held back by cultural norms. She steps forward in boldness and mountain-moving faith. She uses her voice to speak to the mountain in front of her. She effectively tells Jesus he's wrong, and he changes his mind and grants her request. Incredible. So that is my favourite Bible character.
That's a very good choice. I think we've ever had that once, maybe twice, most in all these years gone by. So that's a very good choice. Okay. I actually read about this very thing a few months ago. And I think you can also put another spin on it as well, that there might have been some sort of humour between Jesus and the lady, because that remark, if you take it out of context, as you know, we're brilliant at taking things out of context, but we put the context into it, the fact she was in the room at the first place, you know, maybe he said it with a twinkle in his eye, you know, to see what comes back.
I've read that it could have been like a banter kind of situation.
Exactly.
And I just love that because it shows that Jesus treats us as individuals. Like, I love banter, and I think Jesus would talk like that to me.
Yeah.
But not necessarily to everyone. But I love that he gave her the opportunity to be herself, to have that cheeky faith, that cheeky response, you know. I love it.
Yeah, he might have said, "Hey up, lass.
Hey up, duck."
That's it. What about the bread first? You know, and all that sort of stuff. But said it with a twinkle in his eye. And she knew she could sort of say something in return.
Yeah.
You know, this is what it's all about. It's communication. Mm. So that's question two then. Tick. Question three, you're on a roll. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be? And I'll help you out on this.
Ooh.
Bearing in mind your Anton Deck answer, you are fully allowed to have a frivolous answer here. Just saying.
Oh, okay, lovely. So my new law would be that it would be mandatory for everybody in Britain to learn British Sign Language. And that's because inclusion is a massive passion of mine. So I decided to learn sign language after I met a deaf lady at church. And it really opened my eyes to see how difficult life can be if you don't use speech to communicate and if you can't hear. So I sat down next to this lady. It was in like a cafe situation and quickly realized she was deaf. So I did my best. You know, I did the thumbs up and I did the cheesy grin and that was it. And that was really as far as we could get. So we wrote our names down and really that was about it. And I realized at that point what a limited and isolating world it can be for deaf people.
Yes.
You know, if you think yourself about your daily life, all of the tasks you do, the interactions you have, and then imagine trying to do all of those things if you can't hear and if you don't use speech, if you perhaps you use sign language. And just, yeah, the barriers that deaf people face is huge. The statistic is that 90% of deaf children are born to parents who can hear. So people often think it's like deaf parents have deaf children, and that can happen, but 90% of deaf children are born to parents who can hear, and only 10% of those parents decide to learn sign language in order to communicate with their children. And that then leads to something which is called dinner table syndrome, which is something deaf people experience where, you know, you imagine you're sat around a table and everyone's chatting away.
Yeah.
And you're just sat there not knowing what's going on. You feel completely excluded. You're not involved in the conversation. And you might try and clarify what's just been said. You might be trying to lip read and people say, oh, don't worry, I'll tell you later. And later never comes. And you just don't feel your part. You don't feel you belong. And that's reflected in job situations, in church life, in family life. And it's just such a world full of barriers, really, for deaf people. I think it's funny, like, you know, even if you think about TV, you know, you wake up at 2 a.m, you go and get a drink, you sit down, maybe put the telly on if you can't sleep, and you might see like a rerun of Jeremy Kyle that's signed, and you're like, oh, how wonderful to be deaf and to be able to wake up at 2 and watch a rerun of Jeremy Kyle. You know, it's like, you don't have the options of stuff to watch. It's really random. And
yes.
So just, and even like cinema films are subtitled at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. And it's like, that's not, you know, when I want to go to the cinema.
Yeah.
So yeah, just real passion for inclusion. And
just to highlight what you're saying, my wife is registered blind and has lost everything in her left eye and has got back less than 2% sight left in her right eye, and that's it.
Okay.
And a very well-known film critic a couple of years ago on the radio said that we should have subtitles on every single film because it's so much easier to read when they're doing translations. And he says, I've never met anyone who would disagree with me. Well, I'm sorry, but if you're registered blind and you're relying on somebody to actually tell you what the subtitles are, you try it.
Yeah.
How can people who are registered blind on every little site, they haven't got time to read the small print underneath, let alone ask somebody to read it out? Because I can't act. So how can I put on a voice, some from Scotland, to give an idea who it was? I can't do a Scottish accent, let alone read it whilst trying to watch the film myself. Yeah. Oh, so you see, you and I are on the same page here on this one.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Anyway, sorry, enough of my rant. What were you going to say?
No, it's good. You crack on with your rants. I like a good rant. Yeah, I was just going to say about a book I read. So this is obviously a very idealistic thing, but that's the point of this question, isn't it? But this book was called Everyone Here Spoke Sign Language. And it was about a small town in America. This is years ago. I can't remember the exact dates, but it was called Martha's Vineyard, this town.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically everybody there spoke sign language, what the title was.
Yeah.
Everybody learned how to sign. So people who could speak use speech, but everybody knew how to sign. So if they were out in the community and a deaf person came along, they would like that switch to sign in. So deaf people who lived there just felt fully included. And I just thought it was such a beautiful picture of what, you know, what can happen and what people can achieve, and inclusion is possible. But it's
brilliant.
A lot of hard work, you know. Yeah. It took me 5 years to learn. And I'm certainly still learning. Like, I've by no means mastered it. It's almost like I feel like a beginner. even now after 5 years of learning the language. So it's not, I understand it's not like an easy thing, but I think if you learn it growing up, that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
If it just happens at school, we learn it. Yeah, so that would be my law that I would enforce.
So in a couple of weeks' time, I'm interviewing Tracy Williamson, who's written this new book, Unashamed, Discover the Healing Power of God's Love from Your Wounded Soul. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is that a business partner, because obviously in partnership together here, is Marilyn Baker, who is a blind pianist. But Tracy herself is deaf.
Oh, okay.
And so I thought, well, do you know what? So what if she's deaf? So we've arranged to do a podcast in a couple of weeks' time. Question four then. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date, please?
Okay, so one of my best days out was to Manchester. And I feel I'm just about in the boundaries of your question because it wasn't a family event, but it was an event that made us a family. So it's when we went to the family court in Manchester in March of 2018. And we had a celebration hearing where the little girl that we were fostering became officially adopted into our family. So just as you can imagine, a wonderful experience. We met the judge who signed the official paperwork. It was all very exciting being in court, and the social worker that had seen the case through with us came along as well, which was lovely to have her there. We went to Patisserie Valerie for cake afterwards, so that ticked my box, obviously. And our beautiful girl, she became part of our family forever. So it was just amazing, really joyful, very thankful to God. However, I have a but in this situation.
Oh.
That is a bit of a negative but I think you'll quite enjoy it. So despite the obvious lovely celebration that it was, I had a huge disappointment. So the judge strolled in and he was smartly dressed. He had a suit on, but he was not wearing a wig. Now, you might think, well, what's the big deal? Well, that was a big deal to me because I'd seen, you know, when you look at posts on social media of adoption ceremonies, and basically what happens often is the wig comes off, you get to put the wig on, you get to do the wig selfie, you get to put the wig on your child. So I had just been daydreaming for weeks about the wig. I wanted the wig. I wanted the selfie with the wig. So when this guy comes strolling in, I'm thinking, who's the warm-up act here? Where's the actual judge, you know, with the wig? Anyway, he introduced himself as the judge, and it was like I couldn't help myself. I literally, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, where's your wig? I was like, where's your wig? And I think he was a bit taken aback, you know, and he was like, oh, well, I do have one, but I don't always wear it. And I just thought, oh, this is really bad. But it was just a bit bizarre because he also came in holding a carrier bag, which was full of Yorkie chocolate bars. Now, our daughter was 6 months old, and I kind of thought, that's not really an appropriate gift for a six-month-old child, is it, a Yorkie chocolate bar? So it was all just a little bit bizarre. But anyway, other than the wig disappointment and the Yorkie bars, it was definitely one of the best days ever because, obviously, our little girl became, officially, our little girl, she became a Williams.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, that's brilliant. Well, the thing is, maybe the Yorkie bars were for you.
Yeah, but I didn't get one, though.
Did you?
I felt like I should have got 10 after the wig situation.
Wow.
But I know.
I have to say the pun then. You were obviously pulling your hair out on this one.
Tearing my hair out, yeah.
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 No wig.
No wig.
But a good day out.
Yes, definitely.
Good. Question five then. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date, please?
Okay, so this is linked to my husband being a magician. I really don't like magicians, so this is a bit awkward. Now, my husband, on the magician scale, because they tend to be quite confident, a bit arrogant now, and I think they've got to have a bit of that to do the performance. And,
yes.
You know, so there's got to be a bit of a persona, that's fine, I understand that. But they have to be a bit of a showman or showwoman, don't they? I don't like going to watch magicians because I don't like the banter with them particularly because I know I'm not in control because I know they've got the upper hand because they're going to do an amazing trip. So I went grudgingly to see this magic show and we went with a couple of friends, which was really nice. So I said to him, I am not sitting on the front row because I do not want to be picked. So we went for about the third or fourth row back and I was kind of, I thought, okay, I'm safe here. Not safe. So I got picked and I had to stand up and it was only just where I was. I didn't have to go to the front, fortunately. So most people couldn't see my face to identify me on the way out, which was a positive thing. So I had to stand up and shake a dice in a cup and I had to answer 3 questions. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a shy person. I quite like public speaking. I do some preaching, which I really enjoy, but that's when I've had time to prepare.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm happy to talk to people. Not a problem. I like that when I know I've got something to share. But if you put me on the spot, I'm not so good. My mind just goes a bit blank. And especially yes. when I'm faced with this magician and I already don't really want to be there. So his 3 questions to me were, 1, what's your favourite food? Now, that was quite easy. I've got a sweet tooth, so I said chocolate. And then after that, I could feel the pressure was building. So 2nd question, what's your earliest childhood memory? Well, I couldn't think of anything, so I just went, chocolate again. I'm in quite like a gormless voice as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The last question, and I've just completely lost the plot by now, was what's the strangest thing you've ever eaten? Well, I've never had a kangaroo or a crocodile. I couldn't think of anything. So what do you think I said?
Chocolate.
Chocolate, like that. So the friends, I think he just thought, what is going on here? So he absolutely ripped me to shreds, as you can imagine, you know. And the friends that we went along with just were just rolling with laughter next to me. And
yeah.
for years, they would just shout, chocolate, whenever I came into a room. Or I think my husband, to be fair, my husband was more embarrassed because it was somebody that he knew in the magic world. And he's like, this is your wife. What's going on?
Yeah, but what happened to the trick then?
Oh, no, I can't remember that. I don't know. Oh, I just remember having to shake her down. And I don't know what, I couldn't tell you what the trick was because I was just so... just wanted the ground to swallow me up.
Well, whilst we're talking about magicianships, then, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going back to the early 1980s when I started to go back to church. There was a gentleman in our church whose name was Roger, and I think his stage name was Roger John, I think. And he would do magic shows all around the country, obviously. Was it the Black Magic Circle? Is that what it's called? The Magic Circle? Magic Circle. Yeah, he was in there. Not the Black Magic Circle. That's a chocolate box, isn't it?
That's it.
Yeah, chocolate. And he was able to magic onto the stage his Afghan hound. It was brilliant.
Wow.
I remember asking him in the early days, do you find Christians having to go at you? Oh, you're doing these magic tricks. You know? And he said, well, no, it's just illusions, a sleight of hand. You know, all these years on, your husband is a magician. Does he get any knockbacks from Christians saying you shouldn't do this? Really?
He does. In general, no. Most people are accepting of it. They understand that it's an illusion, it's a trick, it's not, nothing dark is happening. But yeah, sometimes there's been a few occasions where that has definitely happened, yeah. But he just deals with it exactly the same way as Roger did, and explains that, you know, it takes a lot of practice to master these tricks. So I know how some of them are done, but I couldn't do it because I haven't practiced. But there are definitely some people who worry about that.
Yeah.
And because magicians are mentioned in the Bible, aren't they? Like, thinking about Moses when miracles were happening and magicians were doing the same things as it. So I can kind of see the concern, but when you really think about it and you understand how the magic is done, it is sleight of hand. It is an illusion. It's nothing dark or anything like that. But yeah.
Well, kudos here to the NHS, because I'm seeing you on the screen here and you've only got half a body, of course, because he sawed you in half, didn't he?
Exactly. Yeah. But fortunately, I've still got my mouth, so I can still eat cake. You know, so I'm happy. Yeah.
Brilliant. So let's briefly talk about the book, because there's so many other things I'd like to talk about. And obviously, you can reference about your daughter as well. No doubt we'll talk about that as well, which is great. When God Butts In, Finding Strength to Face the Impossible by Kate Williams. Not Kate Williams, the historian.
No.
Why did you write this book then, please?
I found myself a few years ago in quite a challenging situation. So as I explained before in one of your icebreakers, we adopted our daughter. So that had all happened. That was all done. And I just kind of felt like I've got a real passion for children in care. And children having a loving, stable home is something that I just think is so important. Like, it's huge. So we'd adopted our daughter and I kind of thought, I want to do more. I want to do something more. So I chatted to my husband about it and we felt like we could perhaps start with doing some respite foster care, because then it would be like a weekend a month kind of situation. We could support a child, but we could also support their carers in them having a break. So we'd already been approved as foster carers for our daughter initially, because it was foster to adopt program we went through. And we'd also been approved as adopters. So we kind of thought, okay, it'll be pretty straightforward. We'll obviously have, it's a different organisation, so they're going to have to ask us all the questions they normally would. But we've got this file from our other agency that can be transferred over. And we just thought it's going to be a process, but it'll go well. And it did go well. So it was a year long. We got to panel at the end. And panel are like a group of professionals who meet. And they vote basically on whether you should be foster carers. They read all your paperwork, the assessment done by your social worker, and they vote. So they unanimously said yes. We then did a little selfie and put it on Instagram and said, oh, yay, we're going to be foster carers. How exciting is this? About a month later after that, we realized we'd not had an official letter from the agency, which we knew we were waiting for. So I kind of prodded our social worker on that and said, oh, I know this is like a rubber stamping thing, but we've not had this. So she made some inquiries and she rang me back and she said, look, this isn't really good news. And somebody wants to come out and see you about it. Now, this was in COVID as well. So it was a time when people weren't keen to come to your home, really. But this manager insisted that she came round, and it was all within the rules. So she came round and she basically said that the top person at the agency did not want to sign us off and make it official, and they hold all the power. So even though panel had all said yes, and we'd heard before, it's a one in a million situation where the top person goes against the panel because they respect the panel so much. And so it was a really unusual situation, but they said that policies had changed and things linked to stuff in my husband's past, which had all been talked about throughout the whole process and other processes we'd been through. So everything was out on the table. Nothing new. We didn't tell them anything new. There's nothing hidden from us. Yeah, it wasn't going to go through. Well, no, they said it was highly unlikely. So what they said was we could wait, do a bit more assessment work, and then have another panel. But they said even in that case, the top person is highly unlikely to approve you as foster carers. So we were really encouraged to withdraw. And when that manager left, we were just like, couldn't believe it, because we thought it was a done deal. And then all of a sudden there was this twist and this, it's not going to happen really, and this encouragement to back out. So I basically started to write this book at that point. So we were waiting for the final decisions, because we decided no, we were going to go for it, we were going to carry on. And we wanted them, if they were going to say no, they'd have to say the official no and give us, you know, a good reason. I think there's probably about 3 months potentially we waited in between, and that's when I started to write the book. And really, I wrote it to encourage myself. I was a Christian. I became a Christian when I was 8, so I've grown up in church, and I've been around the Bible stories, you know, in the Old Testament particularly, and just incredible stories of what God did. And I just thought, if this is the same God, then why can't he change this situation in my life? So I began to try and look at it in a different way as perhaps I would have before, because naturally I'm very cynical and very negative. Mm-hmm. I don't find it easy to be a person of faith, in all honesty, or a positive person, ask my husband. I just thought, do you know what? If God is real, if this God that I've grown up reading about in the Bible did all these incredible things, then this situation is not a problem for him. And I didn't necessarily think that meant he would definitely do it, because we don't know. We're not God. We don't know his overall plan. But I just thought, I want to approach this situation in faith and not in fear. So I just began to see in the Bible the word but. And it was like, this was the situation, but this is what God did. And I just started to study them and then kind of started to write them each day as a bit of a devotional for myself. And then I would send them on to friends and a couple of friends and to my mum. And they were like, these are good. Like, this could be a book.
Yeah.
So it was kind of their encouragement then that made me think, oh, maybe it could be. Because I'd always loved writing. I'd blogged about adoption for quite a few years, and I'd loved writing, and it was something that was really growing as a passion.
Yeah.
So that it was really their encouragement from me sending them what I was writing that caused me to think about a book.
Without prying too much about your husband's past, but let's just say, even if he was a mass murderer, and I don't think he was.
He wasn't.
Whatever it was in the past, to get to the panel for them to say, yes, it's okay.
Yes, Yeah.
And then for this top bloke to say, or lady, to say, no, it's not okay.
Mm.
What was your husband thinking when he realised it might be something to do with his past?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky one for him, obviously, because you feel the responsibility of that. And there's nothing you can do about your past. It's what's happened.
Yeah.
And all we've done is been completely honest and open. And actually they saw, I mean, my husband's very, very open about his past. So I feel like I can speak about that. He shared on Sunday, he was at a prison in Warrington sharing his story. So he's had time in prison for drug related offences. That was the, you know, the concerns. And in fairness,
thank you for sharing.
Yeah, that's fine. And in fairness to them, if I was the top person and I had someone with drug related convictions that I was considering, do you know what I mean? I can understand why they want to be extremely careful, because we're talking about very vulnerable children.
Yes.
And I, as the top person, having the responsibility of saying, is he a safe person? So it wasn't like I hated them and I thought, how dare, you know, I could understand that there was concern on their part. However, the offences were 20 years ago. We've proved that we have a stable life. We've been married for 17 years. He has a stable job. He's managed people. And we had so many references. They took out extra references, which we absolutely supported. So we felt like we'd done all we could do, really. And yeah, so we just both felt that, no, we need to stand our ground here, because it was seen, his experiences were actually seen as a positive thing to some of the panel, because he's dealt with adversity and difficulty,
yeah,
and challenge, and come out the other side of it completely differently.
Yeah.
So he will be able to help children in a way that I never can, because he's dealt with other issues.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Have you heard any more back from the top panelist person that said no?
We've never heard why the hesitation or anything like that. But what was really interesting was when we got the final go-ahead, they actually approved us for more than we'd asked for. So we'd asked for respite, which basically means once a month,
yeah,
once a week, something like that. But they approved us for respite and short-term care, which meant we could have a child in our home 24/7 for up to 2 years, say, which then may progress to long-term placement. So it was really bizarre. So we were like, hang on, so now you've approved us for a child all the time, potentially. So we were a bit like, okay. But it was just great that it was the green light that we wanted.
Yeah, but you stood your ground. You did it properly.
Yes.
You didn't throw, yeah, the toys out with the bathwater.
No, and I think that was really, really important, because I wanted to,
yeah,
at times. And I did my research, which I think was a really good thing. You know, I asked other agencies, I asked other social workers, I said, look, this is the honest of the past, what's happened. Is this something that should prevent us? And the answer was thorough assessment needed, lots of references needed. And that's exactly what had happened. But the answer was no, that should not prevent you. But I could have taken all that evidence to them.
Yeah.
But we didn't do that. And we felt near the end of the process, we could write a statement. And I just felt that when Jesus was about to be put to death and he remained silent, and he chose to remain silent, you know, he could have said, I'm the Son of God, you shouldn't be doing this to me. And he chose to remain silent. And I felt that really heavily, that I should remain silent. So we did write a very short statement, but we didn't use all the evidence, all the backup we had from other agencies. We didn't go there, because I said to my husband, I just think there's even more faith involved in that, in not using all of that, because it's trusting it to God and saying, right, if God wants us to do this, then he can do it. And we just both felt, now I wouldn't say that for every situation,
mm-hmm,
you know, I wouldn't say you should always just be quiet. There are sometimes you need to be very vocal. But it's just, you have to kind of discern what God's saying to you in a particular situation, I think.
Thank you for saying that, because reading this book as I have, there is that passage in there where you talk about when to be quiet and when not to be, and you make some,
yeah,
biblical references in particular to the Old Testament as well. So I think that's a very good point. But also, you mustn't be used as a doormat either, just to be walked over.
Mm.
So there are protocols. I mean, if you, yeah, had your time again going back on this with the proverbial magic wand, let's go back. Okay.
Izzy Wizzy, let's get busy.
Is that what he says?
No, never. Not in my presence, anyway.
Yeah, sorry. I'm just trying to get rid of sooty and sweep out my mind now. With the proverbial magic wand, then, if we went back, what other processes do you think would you change to make it easier for you now from what you've learned?
I don't think I would change anything, because I think this situation was one I went through in faith. And like I said before, I haven't always done that.
Yeah.
In other situations, when that woman came out to see us and said, it's not going to happen really, like my natural thing would be to shrink back and think, oh no, that's the final verdict. But this time was the time I chose to do it differently. And I chose to think, actually, if God wants us to do this, doesn't matter what the top person says, because it's God's will that prevails. So I think on this occasion was a time when I did things in a way that I'm happy with. Like, and I'm not saying every day I was like, you know, oh, I'm totally in faith and this is going to go our way. I wasn't. It was up and down.
Yeah.
And emails got sent that made it look less likely to happen. And, you know, and I needed the support of other people around me. But I took it, you know.
Yeah.
I asked for it, and we had a WhatsApp group, for example. And if I was feeling a bit stressed, then I would be honest on that and say, please pray for us today because it's a bit of a rough one. And so I think I wouldn't change anything, I don't think, on this occasion, because I think it was just, I went through this differently than I have with other challenges, perhaps.
Because the other side of the coin is, from our point of view, what I mean by that is that, this goes back about 10 years, because my wife and her have been registered blind, and she's got a very rare disease that only about 25,000 people in the UK have got. It's called retinitis pigmentosa, or RP for short.
Mm-hmm.
We realised just how bad the law was on it from a legal point of view, what you can claim, what you can't claim, the way that they assess. So we found a solicitor who was prepared to back us, and we got it pro bono.
Great. Yeah.
And got it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the legal team from the government were saying, this is not our finest 5 minutes. But, you know, we fell at the final hurdle. Like yourself, we did a lot of prayer about it, and we felt that what we were doing was trying to fly the flag, not just for my wife, but for 25,000 people in the UK.
Yeah.
Why did God let us go through it? I don't know. You know, why did it cause so much stress that has been in my life ever since on that? I don't know. But we did it. And would I change a single thing? No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. And no doubt one day we'll find out, you know, through this, why God allowed it to happen.
And that's interesting, because that's very much how my book ends. And I think people are surprised about how the book ends. So yes, we got approved, we got the green light, and we did foster. However, my dream with the fostering was to add another little person to our family eventually. Whether that was in 5-10 years time, I was chilled about that, and I knew it needed to be the right timing. But that was the dream. And actually, it was a deaf child. I would have loved to have supported a deaf child and had a deaf child in our family. And basically, we fostered. We were active in foster care. It was positive, but it stretched us beyond our capacity. Really, the upshot of it is we don't do it. So we did it for, say, 18 months, and now we are not foster carers now. So it did not go in any way as I had dreamed, hoped, planned that it would. And we, like you did with what you were battling for, you invest a lot emotionally, physically. You are 100% in. You are fighting for this cause. You want this to happen because you believe it's what God's calling you to do, and it's going to help other people. So how can it not be God? And all of that. So you're dealing then with the disappointment of, hang on, the hours that we put in, because even if you don't have a child in placement, the training courses you have to do, the drop-ins, coffee mornings you to link with other carers, the supervisions with your social worker. You have something called unannounced visits, which are just the worst ever, because you stood in the kitchen chopping your onions for your tea, and there's a knock at the door, and then suddenly there's a social worker who's now going to walk all around your house, and you're thinking, are the underpants in the basket?
Yes.
Is the bed made? Is there anything out that might look a bit dangerous? And it's going to, you know, so it's all of those kind of things. Like, it was a huge investment of time and emotion. And really, yes, we did do it. And we had a placement for a year of a young man who came once a month. And it was good. It was really positive, really positive. But it was not what I dreamed about. And coming to terms with that was really difficult, because it was like grieving the loss of a dream and grieving all this energy and time we've put in, and it's not gone. And also grieving that I don't have the capacity to do it, because we realised once a month was too much of a strain even. And I thought, I just felt rubbish. I thought, I've got one child. I know people with six children. I know people who raise chickens, who make their own jam, who knit their own jumpers, and they've got jobs and six children and hobbies, and they manage to be quite a nice person as well. And I'm just thinking, I cannot do that. I do not have that capacity. And it was like a bit of a journey in understanding about not comparing myself to other people and accepting who God has made me and the level of capacity that I do have, and embracing that and accepting that, and grieving that that dream in particular, you know, at least for now, and probably not ever, it is gone. And that's hard.
Yeah. What people don't know, and you do bring this out in the book, is the fact that your daughter isn't just an ordinary daughter. She's even more special.
She is indeed.
Tell us more, please.
Chloe is our homie with an extra chromie.
Oh, that's brilliant. Did you make that up?
No, I didn't. I would like to take the credit for that one, but that would be wrong. It was not my thing. But yeah, so Chloe has Down syndrome. She is just the most wonderful little human ever created. She really is an absolute gift to us. She makes us laugh every day. She's very funny. She's very cheeky. She's very sassy. But she's just beautiful, and she absolutely is the fulfillment of a dream. We really wanted to adopt a child with Down syndrome. That was a very specific thing.
Yeah, why?
Yeah, so really random, because often people assume if you've adopted that it means you can't have children. I wrote a blog many years ago called 10 Things to Say to Adoptive Parents That Will Make Them Want to Punch You in the Face. a very gentle read, you know. One of the things was, I literally told someone we were going to adopt, and their first response, and this was a Christian, was, have you not thought of IVF? I didn't even say anything because I was just so taken aback. I think I was just stunned.
Maybe she meant the Icelandic volunteer force.
Maybe that's what they meant. Oh,
maybe it's a different IVF.
Yes. Yeah. Very gracious response. But yeah, so I just thought, well, that's a huge assumption, because that's assuming that, number one, I can't have children. And I thought, what? You know, it wasn't somebody that I knew well that had made this statement either. So yeah, there's often quite a big assumption if you've chosen to adopt that it's like a second-rate option. And it is absolutely not. Like for me, it came totally out of the blue. I have not grown up wanting to adopt. I haven't, you know, for years thought this is something I was going to do. So it came quite out of the blue to me, really. But it was very strong when it came. And I supported a girl with Down syndrome when, I think maybe about 10 years ago now, like on a one-to-one basis, and we'd go out and have a meal, or we'd go to the cinema. And it was lovely. And she was just a beautiful person. And I think Down syndrome was something I just felt quite familiar with. It wasn't something I was scared of, or yeah, I just thought people with Down syndrome were wonderful. And I just felt that I could give good support and love to a child with those needs, really. I just saw adoption as really God's heart and what God does for us as well. You know, we're not born into a relationship with him. And then when we choose it, we are adopted into his family forever. And it's not just that thing of our sins are dealt with, but it's, we have a Father God who loves us. You know, we're his children forever. And I just love that. And I think adoption is such a beautiful picture of the gospel. And yeah, so it came very, very strong, but out of the blue as well. Quite a surprise to me, and definitely a surprise to my husband.
I bet.
Yeah.
What did he say? What did he do?
Well, so I thought, I'm going to have a bit of a game plan here, because this is very, very random. So I'm about to tell my husband I want to adopt, and I want to adopt a child with Down syndrome. I thought, this is pretty big. So what I did was, I told him, but I said to him, I said, what I want to do is give you 6 months. I want you to think about it, pray about it, and we'll see how you feel at the end of that time period. And I'm not going to mither you. I'm not going to go on about it. I'm just going to leave you. And that was the hardest 6 months of my life. I felt like I needed to move out, really, so I could fulfill that promise of not mithering him about it. But yeah, by the time he got to the end of that period, he was up for it. So amazing, really, because it's a huge deal. You know, it really is. You know, raising a child with additional needs, it's not easy, but it's absolutely wonderful. And it was 100% the right thing for us.
Why?
it's really hard to express, but she's just the daughter of my dreams is the way I can put it. Like, I feel like people sometimes think, oh, it's amazing what you've done. But actually what she gives to us is so much more than what we give to her, I believe. Like, the lives she impacts is huge. Like, our family, our friends, people at school, everybody knows her, everybody loves her, and she just brings joy wherever she goes, and she's just a little blessing. She really is.
That's an amazing answer. I did say at the front end about you like to goal set, and here's one.
Yes.
You've given 6 months. Now, why 6 months? Because I couldn't have done that. I would say I'll give you a week max. So why 6 months?
I think I just felt like it was a huge thing, and it's a complete life-altering thing. I wanted him to be really sure. I didn't want him to feel bullied into it or emotionally manipulated into it or anything like that. I thought, we have got to be on the same page with this because it's so huge. And so I didn't want to do 6 months. I didn't want to do 6 minutes. I was ready to sign up and get the process going because I knew it was going to be so long, the process as well, because like the approval's at least a year, really. And then you've got the matching part. So I knew probably I was thinking at least 2 years of that. And so I knew from giving him 6 months, you're looking at what, maybe 2 or 3 years ahead.
Yeah.
So the waiting was hard. It's got to be right. If we're doing it, we're doing it together, and we're both got to be sure.
Okay, be honest then. Be honest. How many times did you nag him in those 6 months if he'd come up with an answer or anything else like that?
I don't think I did,
but
the 6 months happened to end on Christmas Eve, and I was like, I don't care if it's Christmas Eve, we are having the conversation.
Brilliant.
So we did have the conversation. We had the conversation in a coffee shop called The Overflowing Cup, which is in Idle, Bradford, where he said, no, I do believe that God's in this and I believe we should do it. And it was there that I had my book launch for this book. So that was really, really special. Yeah, so it's a very special place to us, that coffee shop. Yeah,
that's brilliant.
Yeah.
But what would have happened there if he said, look, I really feel no?
I don't know. I really don't know. Because I felt really strongly about it. I would have just had to give him another 6 months, give him an extension and say, come on, God. You need to work harder on him.
I want you to hear God, but put it this way, no food for you for the next 6 months, sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Or maybe like 6 months in the shed. Give him a bed. And
Exactly. No pressure. You know, I want it to be your choice.
But. You say but very, you see, this is like the north-south divide, I think, because I say but, but you say but.
But, yes.
You? But.
That's because I was brought up proper, like, not me.
You were brought up proper, not in Yorkshire.
Yeah, it's great, the language, isn't it? And how people say different things. It's over here in Northern Ireland where I now live. They don't say mirror. They say mur.
Mur.
Yeah.
Looking at mur.
That's it, yeah. And the other funny thing is as well, is that when you go and get your fish and chips, it's like, do you want a chip with that? And I'm going, no, I want chips. But for some reason, when you have fish over here, you have a chip.
You have fish and a chip?
Yeah.
But you do get an actual bag of chips?
Oh, yes. Agricultural portions, normally.
Right. How strange.
The wonders of the language, isn't it? One of the other things I'd like to talk about, if that's okay, working alongside children who are deaf, and I've mentioned it already, but why did you want to do that?
Yeah, so I started off in a school. So I worked in a school for a year, and to be quite honest, it was awful. So that was with like 11 to 15, 16-year-olds in a secondary school. But I'd literally just at that point learnt level two. And that is not very much BSL, to be honest.
British Sign Language, BSL?
British Sign Language, yeah. So basically at that point, you've done 2 years of going once a week and learning for 2 or 3 hours. I'd never worked with a deaf person up until then. And all of a sudden, I'm thrown into a classroom and I've got to try and sign what's happening in the class or the assembly. And it's like being, say, you were over in France and you know a bit of French and you're like, je m'appelle, you know, it's that level of you're trying to operate in a different language and you've not got the skill to. So it was really, really challenging. But you've got to get your experience somehow as well. So I did that for a year, but school was just not my bag. That age group is not my bag. I mean, it was all good experience and it was the right thing. I actually believe it was the right thing to do, but it was not easy at all. It was very, very challenging. But then I moved from there to a sixth form college, and that is much more suited to me because students there, they've picked what they want to do. They've picked their course. They're invested more in it. At school, you just found a lot of them had their heads on the table, so they're not even looking at bothered what you're signing. You could be doing heads, shoulders, knees and toes. They don't care because they just don't want to be there. But at college, it's like they're more invested. They want to be there. They want to learn. They're perhaps thinking about the career they want and they're working towards that. So they're older, so they're really 17 plus, and some of them are in their 30s as well, who I work with, which I absolutely love. I definitely enjoy working with adults. That's my thing. And now, because I've had probably 3 years now experience, my signing is better. It's not amazing, but it's good enough that I can do that and convey, you know, quite a decent chunk of what's happening, and just also have a chat with them as well in a formal way. And so, yeah, I really enjoy it. It's very varied. You can be at a garage doing mechanics 1 minute, and then you're in a hairdressing salon the next minute, and then it's maths, and then it's art. And so it's very, very varied, but it's really good.
Well, that's really good. And goal setting then, what's all that about? Why do you like goal setting so much?
Oh, I just love, because I just think without it, people faff. We've got one short life, like stop faffing. Like people have all these dreams, but unless you put goals in place, you're not going to get there. And it's like life just goes quickly, doesn't it? Like the days, the weeks roll by. And if you have a dream to do something, it's like you've got to get a plan. So I love a list. I love a plan. I love like visual charts. I read Atomic Habits last year, and that was just a fabulous book. And yeah, I just think having goals is so important. If you've got stuff you want to do on this planet, get it done and get a plan to get it done. Don't faff.
Well, that's a great answer, because I think the way I would sum up your book is asking you a question.
Oh.
How do you spell faith?
How do you spell faith? What do you mean?
The answer is R-I-S-K.
Oh, I've heard this before. Yeah. Okay.
There's a risk to everything. And you either go for it or you don't, but you have to pray for it. And, you know, it's never going to be that easy. And I always remember Adrian Plass in his book, and he was talking about laying a fleece down. You know, should I do this? Am I going to do this? Right, if that's the case, then at 8:08 tomorrow morning, I want a Japanese admiral in full regalia to turn up at the door. And if he's not there 8:08, then I'm not going to do it.
I'm not doing it, yeah.
That's not really risk, is it? Amazing enough, and Japanese admiral did turn up. No, he didn't, no. No, you didn't. But yeah, what do you think then about faith and risk then, from your point of view?
I definitely think there's an element of risk within faith, because I think when I was writing this, you know, the book is written in the middle of that time. It's not written from the end where we got the green light looking back. It's written where I don't know the ending. And I think that is risk as well, isn't it? Like writing all this faith-filled stuff down and what I believed God was saying. And because I did feel God was saying he was going to do it.
Yeah,
and I think there's a risk in sharing that with people. I definitely think you have to step out and take some risks to see God move. And like that woman we talked about at the start, the Canaanite woman.
Yes,
she could. When Jesus said that to her about tossing bread, she could have just pulled back and gone, and that end of conversation. But she thought, no, I'm going to take a risk. I'm stepping forward. I'm going to say something cheeky back and see what happens. And I think God really responds to that.
Yeah. Well, you took a risk as well, didn't you? Your step of faith, your R-I-S-K, having been told that the top cheese said no.
Yeah.
You knew the protocols, what you could do. And maybe and some protocols you didn't know that you had to use as well. And look what happened as a result of it, part of your journey as well, on the book front as well, finishing it off. How many people have sat down to start writing a book and have never got to the punchline?
Yeah, that's because they've not got goals. They need a plan and they need some goals.
Yes, which I used to train a lot about back in my yesteryear.
Oh, did you? You're into all that.
Oh, big, your ambitions, your dreams, and all that sort of stuff, your wants, your needs, ambitions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good stuff, yeah.
Before we get into who your Christian hero is.
Oh, yeah.
The very beginning of the book, have I given enough plugs yet? When God Butts In by Kate Williams, available all good Christian bookshops, well worth checking out and going to buy. But right at the very beginning, you dedicate this book to Gwen Kirby, who died sadly 2 years ago. I'm assuming this is not your Christian hero.
She is.
All right, well, in that case then, that's just what I said it then. What a great intro, because I do love flying the flag for people. who have been chosen that no one's ever really heard of.
Yeah.
So with that in mind then, tell us more, please, Kate, why Gwen Kirby is your Christian hero.
Yeah, so like you said, Gwen passed away a couple of years ago, and I dedicated my book to her because she's a person that's had a massive influence on me. And I was able to share the dedication with her through a friend that visited her in hospital just before she passed away.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so that was really nice. So she never got to read the book, but she knew about it and she knew about the dedication. She's my Christian hero because she was a strong, feisty, funny, outspoken, faith-filled woman. We also shared a love for knitting. So I was the warden of the site that she lived on. This is going back about 10 years now. And I set up a knit and natter group, which we were both part of.
Oh, wow.
And just really enjoyed that. And I would love to have a faith and a walk with God like Gwen had. She was teaching the Bible into her 90s. She taught me when I was 18 on a gap year, and she's impacted many, many people's lives. So I'm going to read a section from the book about her, if that's okay.
Please.
There's also a reference to Esther in these paragraphs I read, because this chapter is about the story of Esther from the Old Testament.
Mm.
So here we go for Gwen. One thing I've been reflecting on recently is the level of faith I see in older Christians. We have a lovely friend called Gwen who is 94 and is currently in hospital with a body that's full of cancer. She's been told she has a couple of weeks to live. We don't live close by, but fortunately my husband was able to visit her in hospital this week. Despite what she's experiencing, she remains full of wit and humour. She's as strong-willed as ever. She's cheerful, hopeful, and confident in a loving God. I believe this is the case because the foundations of her life and faith are solid. She's spent hours upon hours of her life reading and studying God's word. She's faithfully prayed, fasted, and spent regular quality time with God. These spiritual disciplines mean she can face this difficult time with faith and not fear, much like Esther did. Without the foundations of these spiritual disciplines, being brave and bold may still be commended, but I don't believe it's anywhere near as effective. The combination of building your life on spiritual disciplines, often modelled by the older generation of Christians, coupled with a commitment to walking in faith and not fear, means you can face difficult times with courage because you have a deep and solid relationship with God. When I compare the way I respond to challenges in life to the way my friend Gwen is responding to her situation, I see a real disparity. I'm often so angry at God for what I'm facing, or I'm weak and whyme.com. I want to look at the examples of both Gwen and Esther, two women who were confident in the power of God, but who also took seriously the importance of putting in the hard work of developing their relationships with God. These women inspire me to evaluate my life and make changes to what gets my time and attention. And then I'll just read the brief dedication as well.
Please.
Gwen, I want to thank you for your example of being a person of true faith, joy, and trust in the face of some very challenging circumstances. Your walk of faith has given me great hope that it's possible to go through difficult times and still maintain a tenacious spirit, a quick wit, and a deep level of trust in Jesus, and a cheeky twinkle in your eye. You're an amazing lady who has imparted so much into so many people's lives. You are much loved and will be very missed here. I look forward to a knit and natter with you again one day in our heavenly home. Please save me a seat by you and a big piece of cake. So that is Gwen, and she is my hero.
Lovely. And what else do we know about her?
So she used to be a missionary with her husband, Bill, in Africa for many years. So just taught the Bible out there for years. Yeah, trained lots of church leaders. And then she came over here maybe 15, 20 years ago now. And she lived at the site that I was the warden on. And she, yeah, just continued to teach the Bible. So there was a gap year program at the church, so that each year there'd be different students come into that. And there was also a rehab center on the site. So she would go and do Bible studies with them and chapel services with them. And just such a character, and just loved the Lord and loved people.
Wow.
People just loved being around her because she was very funny and just solid in her faith. Yeah.
What did she say in the rehab centers then?
Just Bible teaching. So they would have like regular devotions in the morning or like a weekly chapel service, and she'd be involved in both of those, just getting them to read the Bible as well and to understand it. Yeah, she was a real teacher and had a real love for the Bible and, yeah, just loved to teach it.
Wow, brilliant. And her name again, please?
Gwen Kirby.
Gwen Kirby. Fantastic. Yeah, I love stories like that. It's amazing what we can learn from them as well. If there's one thing that you might have learnt from Gwen Kirby's life, just one thing out of several things, what would it be?
I would say her trust in God that was just solid, really solid, and a trust in the Bible that when she went through this experience of cancer that was really hard, she was able to still trust God and to remain happy, joyful, calm, confident in a good God, even in the face of a really awful situation.
That's a great answer. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed today's podcast.
Me too.
Hey, we'll have to do it again sometime. Yeah. Kate Williams, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.